Our speaker today, a native Californian, is one of San Francisco's most honored citizens. I had an introduction planned, but I'm going to cut it so he can start speaking. He's from the Asian American Studies Department in San Francisco State University, here to speak on the subject of Japanese Americans, Americans once removed. Mr. Edison Uno.
Thank you very, very much, Pat. This is San Luis Obispo. I got up at 5:30 this morning and caught a plane, and unfortunately, I thought it was hijacked, but when it got to San Jose and Paso Robles, I think it was like a horse. It had to stop and it had to wait, and it waited and waited, and I thought I'd never get here. And so I am very grateful for you people who had the patience to wait here and give me this kind of a reception. Let me put in a plug for Swift Airlines. I think they ought to change their name. I wish to thank the university and the Tomodachi Kai for inviting me to participate in your convocation series. As I was preparing for this presentation, I thought I would share with you some of the early history of this particular area. The fact that for many decades, this geographic and scenic part of California played an important role in the experience of Japanese Americans and their contribution. Some of the largest Japanese American farms were in this county, and they were giants in the early development of the large-scale truck farming in this county. But just two nights ago, I was reading my San Francisco Examiner, and an Associated Press news item struck my attention. The headline said, quote, "Too many Orientals," unquote. The news item from Washington stated that Representative Bert Talcott said today he was, quote, "pleased to announce that neither Camp Roberts nor Camp San Luis Obispo, both in San Luis Obispo County, will be used to shelter Vietnamese refugees." Talcott, a Republican from Salinas, who represents Monterey and San Luis Obispo counties, said that, "while my district is more positive, understanding, and compassionate than some other areas, there is another feeling. Damn it, we have too many Orientals." Talcott's office said later that his reference to Orientals reflected the views of some of his constituents, but not his own. I seriously question that in view of the phrase, "damn it." The Japanese American situation today has been often publicized as being the model minority, the successful minority. And in many circles, we are considered to be outstanding citizens and contributors to society. When we hear that former San Jose Mayor Norman Mineta was elected last November to the House of Representatives, it made us feel proud. When we hear of another Nisei, Honorable Tom Habino, being elected mayor of the city of Salinas, we feel proud. And when we heard that a young Japanese American was elected recently to the state assembly, we begin to think that we have attained some degree of political, social, and economic success. But listen to Talcott's statement once again. Quote, "damn it, we have too many Orientals," unquote. Absorb it, digest it, remember it. Now listen to this quote of May 9th, 1942, 33 years ago, by an official of the California Growers and Shippers Association in Salinas. Quote, "We are charged with wanting to get rid of the Japs for selfish reasons. We might as well be honest. We do. They came into this valley to work, and they stayed to take over. If all the Japs were removed tomorrow, we would never miss them, because the white farmers can take over and produce everything the Japs grow, and we won't want them back when the war ends either." Unquote. I hate to say it, but the fact is that racism is alive and well in this county. The hate campaigns against Asian Americans has again raised its ugly head. We must face the fact that hate, fear, greed, and hysteria of the pre-war days of the 1940s is ever present. That in spite of the fact that we have toiled hard, sacrificed, endured hardships, and collectively tried to become part of Middle America, we are still looked upon as foreigners in our own country. The Japanese American experience is one of a long struggle. And as we prepare to celebrate the 200th birthday of our country, it should be remembered that the history of Japanese in America is over 100 years old. The first immigrants arrived in Northern California in 1869. They came to establish the tea and silk farm in Gold Hill near Sacramento. Japanese were imported to America to replace the Chinese as a form of cheap labor. In the railroads, the mines, the timber mills, and in agriculture, they toil to help build the West. The work was hard, the hours long, the pay was little, and the adversities great. The early pioneers had to struggle, coming from a land that was virtually unknown to the West. They brought an alien language, religion, culture, and customs. By the first decade of this century, they came in large numbers, settling in and about the ports of entries of Seattle, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. Most of the early immigrant pioneers were young and strong. They originally came as sojourners, that is, to earn money and to return to Japan with their fortunes. But their dreams of saving and returning seldom came true. The West was also young, and there was plenty of land. Unlike their homeland, they discovered the vastness of the unsettled and undeveloped lands of the West Coast. It was the answer to many of their dreams. And many decided to stay and make America their home, the country of their choice. But there were dark clouds on the horizon. Whites who exploited the Chinese, who had preceded the Japanese, became fearful of the economic competition the Japanese immigrants posed. After their usefulness as cheap labor diminished, some of the Japanese moved to the towns and cities to establish commercial enterprises where their skills and labors would provide them a modest standard of living. They engaged in small businesses such as tailors, cobblers, barbers, laundries, dry goods stores, restaurants, hotels, bathhouses, and other similar types of service businesses. Others took on more ambitious endeavors such as farming, horticulture, fishing, art goods, import-export, and produce marketing. Many were pioneers in their respective fields and introduced new and original methods as they attained growth and financial success. Once there was a determination to remain in America because of the opportunities available, the pioneers began to establish their roots here. Those who can afford the time and money returned to Japan to find wives. Others used a practical and less expensive method by obtaining picture brides, young ladies who were married by proxy in Japan and arrived in America to join her new husband by this unique marriage arrangement. They were called picture brides because they were selected by photographs, and oftentimes the marriage go-between or broker represented the husband-to-be by a handsome touched-up photograph. Amazingly, a large percentage of these marriages were very successful and became the foundation for the strong family ties they produce. These early immigrants were called Issei, the first generation in the United States. Again, the Issei story is one of struggle and survival. They had untold hardships, yet they managed to survive severe discrimination, economic depressions, war, language and cultural hardships, and numerous other obstacles, which made life exceedingly difficult for them. Every phase of their existence was in some way controlled by discriminatory laws, and what was not legislated or adjudicated by the courts was enforced by social custom. The Issei could not immigrate freely as other European immigrants. Therefore, their family unity was obstructed. They could not become naturalized American citizens like other immigrants from Europe. They could not buy, own, or lease land. In other words, they could not legally buy their own home, farm, or business. The California Alien Land Law was enacted to prevent them from owning a precious piece of America, the land they loved, the birthplace of their children. The Issei could not marry non-Japanese in this state. In fact, a special law was passed which divested the citizenship of any American-born Japanese-American female who married an Issei. The racist nature of this law is quite evident. It was designed to prevent the establishment of families by the penalty of renunciation of one's citizenship by a consummation of marriage. The early Japanese were faced with segregated schools. They were denied and excluded from equal educational opportunities. They were denied the right to vote or hold public office because they were prevented by law the right to citizenship. Yet, they were taxpayers, law-abiding residents, rarely a burden to society and its social service agencies. They were proud people. They were model citizens, but they were never considered Americans. They were called Orientals. They were called heathens. And worst of all, they were called Japs. They were the victims of the most vicious attack by organized groups. The Anti-Oriental League was a statewide network of organizations whose primary goal was to eliminate and discriminate against Asian Americans. The Hearst Press, the McClatchy Press, were responsible for fanning the flames of hate in their vociferous campaign of yellow peril. The hate slogans and propaganda used to further racism in California. After 40 years of an active Yellow Peril campaign, the culmination comes shortly after the beginning of World War II. Its effectiveness comes in the form of President Roosevelt's Executive Order 9066. The decree which gives the military the power to establish concentration camps in America without charge, without trials, without guilt, 110,000 persons of Japanese descent are forced into assembly centers, later evacuated to relocation centers. Due process and equal protection of the law are ignored. All constitutional and civil rights are denied. Indeed, the years of hate paid dividends as 2/3 of the evacuees were American-born citizens. Although we were fighting Germany and Italy, yet German-Americans and Italian-Americans were not incarcerated en masse. The government attempted to justify this gross miscarriage of justice by telling the public it was for military necessity and it was also for our own protection. The Constitution and the law was subverted to serve the purpose of those who would profit from our removal. There was no military necessity because there was no cause to suspect the loyalty of Japanese Americans. J. Edgar Hoover, director of the FBI, opposed the evacuation because he did not believe there was any internal security risk at large. And if it was a military necessity, how does the government explain that there was no mass evacuation of Japanese Americans from Hawaii? Surely it was one of the most important and strategic military bases necessary to wage a naval battle against our Pacific enemy. There was no clear and present danger. We proved our loyalty by the thousands who volunteered and who fought valiantly in the armed services of the United States, in Italy, in France, in China, Burma, India, and in the Pacific, where Japanese American GIs served in military intelligence against the enemy, often at the risk of double jeopardy because they looked like the enemy. The argument that it was for our own protection is equally fraudulent. We were prisoners in our own country. One cannot compare the death camps of Nazi Germany with our concentration camps. However, there is no doubt in my mind that if necessary, we would have been used as pawns in prisoner of war exchange, or if the Axis powers had developed the atomic bomb first, I'm certain we would have been used as hostages. The truth of the matter is that the entire episode was motivated by racism, hysteria, economic and political opportunism. Let there be no mistake about it. There were many who would profit from our removal. The San Francisco Federal Reserve Bank estimated our property losses to be in excess of $400 million. A lot of people gained materially from our misery. Farms were lost, crops abandoned, homes, automobiles, furniture, businesses, fishing boats, greenhouses, and much of the wealth of years of saving and sacrifice were sold at a pittance of their real value. And that is not to mention the hardship, the heartbreak, the struggle, the indignities that many families went through as a result of the evacuation. Much of all that was stored was either vandalized or stolen. What was not lost to the greed the government took by illegal means in the name of escheat proceedings, a legal process whereby the government took farms and lands held in the name of their Nisei children. The evacuation effectively bankrupted our community. a lifetime of savings, the dreams and hopes were destroyed by our incarceration. And then there were those who would gain politically from our misfortune. In 1942, California Attorney General Earl Warren, a very powerful political figure, had ambitions of becoming governor of this state. The Japanese Americans became his political football. He scored many times over, resulting in a very successful landslide election to the governorship in 1943. Yes, it was the same Earl Warren who later became Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, who, in my opinion, was the chief architect of the evacuation. Warren made some pretty racist statements in 1942, a fact of history very seldom reported in your classrooms or in our history books. But that is all in the past, or is it? Most Japanese Americans avoid talking about their camp experience. To many, it is like a bad nightmare, one they wish to forget. I think it's like one who has been raped, raped of one's civil liberties, raped of one's dignity. Like rape, it is very difficult to talk about the painful and unpleasant experience. However painful, however unpleasant, I think we must examine and research it, for the Japanese American experience is not unique in the sequence of American history. No, our camps were not the first concentration camps. The first concentration camps exist today. Of course, I'm referring to the Indian reservations, which are a shameful reminder of man's inhumanity to man. Examine the plight of the migrant workers. Consider our prison system. Look at our educational system. Think of poverty and hunger. Consider the way we mistreat our aged. These and many more examples are indeed concentration camps, which psychologically lock people in to oppressive situations. We spent $150 billion in Southeast Asia, billions in space technology, billions to subsidize the military-industrial complex. And we boast of our wealth and intellect, and yet we cannot solve some of the very basic problems of human needs. Yes, Mr. Talcott, Congressman Talcott, many of the Vietnamese refugees are wives and families of American servicemen and civilians. Many of them were those who befriended us during the war and had no choice but to flee because of their cooperation with our military. But remember, Mr. Congressman, when you use the term too many Orientals, you are also including thousands and thousands of loyal, patriotic, decent, dutiful, honest, hardworking, distinguished American citizens of Asian ancestry, many who may be second, third, fourth, or fifth generation Americans. Racism has no place in America. If seeds of racism are being germinated here in San Luis Obispo County, I strongly feel it is the duty and obligation for institutions such as Cal Poly to denounce it and to take steps to eliminate it here and now. In conclusion, I believe a public apology is in order. Californians of goodwill must not abdicate their integrity to the bigots and racists who make a mockery of a free society. I thank you for your indulgence and for your invitation to participate in this program. I'm sorry that I was more than an hour late due to Swift Airlines, but with circumstances beyond our control, I will be very happy to remain and answer any questions that you might have of me. I realize that it's 12 o'clock and others, some of you may have other classes to attend, but I do sincerely appreciate your attentiveness and your presence here. Thank you very, very much. I've said some very provocative things, and I said them purposely in hopes that I would elicit some sort of reaction from the audience, and I would welcome any questions that you might have.
Yeah, please do ask some questions. I know that a group like this that was willing to wait to hear as long as you did for this presentation is really interested. And we do have a luncheon scheduled for Mr. Uno, but I have already arranged for that to be delayed by about 15 minutes. So we do have 15 minutes that we could ask some questions. And while that's happening, I'm going to ask Pat Akita if she'll come up here and stand alongside of you so that this photographer can get some pictures of the two of you together.
That's the most pleasant part of this task.
Can we have Thank a question? You. Just stand up where you are.
Come closer. I think you want to
be in the show.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could comment on the situation that led to the internment of the Japanese. Was that the same carryover of the atmosphere that led to the Germans' agreement, or were they isolated incidents?
There are historians and there are scholars who view history from a political standpoint of view, and there are those who feel that the seeds of Pearl Harbor were actually sown in 1906 when 93 Japanese-American children were separated in the San Francisco City School system. They felt that the pride, the integrity of Japanese nationals was challenged by the San Francisco School District, and it was through the negotiations from the president at that time, President Theodore Roosevelt, who sent an emissary to San Francisco and also negotiated with the Japanese government to come up with the gentleman's agreement. That gentleman's agreement, as you know, was a one-sided agreement whereby Japan would limit its immigration and United States would desegregate those 93 school children. There are those who look at history in terms of the gentleman's agreement, the alien land law, the fact that Japanese Americans could not become naturalized citizens, the Cable Act, which took away the citizenship of Nisei, if they married an Issei, and a host of other discriminatory acts, which really led to the kind of nationalism and resulted in Pearl Harbor. If you study books such as prejudice war in the Constitution, the Great Betrayal, any historic account of Japanese in the United States, I'm certain that you would come to the same conclusion that the execution of Executive Order 9066 is a natural consequence of the Hearst campaign, the McClatchy campaign, the Yellow Peril campaign, all part and parcel of the racist history in San Francisco, in California. Remember, Japanese Americans were not evacuated in Hawaii. They were not evacuated in the Midwest or in the East. There was not one case of sabotage or espionage by persons of Japanese ancestry during World War II. On the contrary, they served with distinction and honor on every battlefield. And in that sense, I think that many of the Nisei paid dearly for the kind of freedom we enjoy today. And ironically, we are being threatened again because of the economic influence of Japan. A great number of people are beginning to see the similarity between 1942 and 1975. Look at the Save the Whale campaign, a very good campaign as far as environmentalists and far as endangered species. But you know, we see children, excuse me, we see third and fourth grade children bringing home